This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. March 14th marks Equal Pay Day, the day that indicates how far into the year women must work in order to reach pay parity with their male counterparts from the previous year. Although there's been progress on some aspects of women's rights over the decades, the pay gap between men and women has stubbornly persisted. On average, women who are employed full-time earn only 84% of their male peers. The pay gap increases for women of color, with Black women earning 67% and Latina and Indigenous women earning 57% of what men earn. My guest is Michelle Kilpatrick, Co-Director of Advocacy and Mobilization at the Center for Popular Democracy. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So Equal Pay Day is something that unfortunately still hasn't necessarily entered the mainstream discourse, but it's important for you and your organization. Why exactly? Why is this an important thing to highlight?
Well, it's important to note how much farther we have to go in terms of making sure that we have equality regardless of gender in the workplace. And so as you just stated, we talk about March 14th as Equal Pay Day, but that really applies primarily to white women. For Black women, it's not until September. For Latina women, it's not until, I believe, December. And so we have this breakdown of the ability to move up, the ability to have stable housing, to access quality healthcare, to access all of the things that go along with that, particularly for women who are single heads of households. There are longstanding consequences for this throughout our economy and throughout our communities.
Now, I understand that part of the gender pay gap is more pronounced in industries that are dominated by women. You see, or overall, you see industries where women are dominant have suppressed wages overall. So education, nursing, et cetera. Is that something that is consistent with what you've seen?
Yeah, so I think what we see is that there is a devaluing of care in our society, and that really hits women going and coming. So if you are the person in your family who's the primary caregiver, the fact that there is not access to affordable childcare or affordable elder care or help with a person in your family who might have disabilities, and that is going to fall particularly heavily on women who tend to be the primary caregivers and families for their family members. On the flip side of that, if you are a woman who works in those professions as a home health aide, as a child care worker, as a teacher, those are also professions that are not paid very well, again, because we just don't value that work and historically have not valued that work. And so what either side of the equation, you are going to be suffering from our inability to recognize how important that kind of care, those jobs are.
Is the pay in those industries low because we don't value the work and therefore women are the ones relegated to it? Or is it that the pay remains low because women are the ones dominating the industries? The sort of chicken or egg question there, or do those factors work together and it's hard to extricate them?
Well, I do think those factors work together. I also think that it's important to think of this in structural terms. So we had in the Build Back Better legislation that was proposed last year, there were plans in place, championed in particular by Senator Elizabeth Warren, that would both increase the pay of people in care professions, particularly when it comes to childcare and home health care, and also provide subsidies to support the families who need those kinds of services. That did not go through. And in fact, we're seeing in the budget fight that's going on right now, increasing threats to the programs that families, particularly families led by women, tend to rely on. And so it's not a matter of just sort of letting the market decide for this. If we really care about closing the wage gap and also providing quality care for our young people, for people with disabilities, and for our elderly, we need to make investments in those. And that means both investing in workers, investing in the number of services available in that workforce, and providing support for the families who need those services.
Now, the wage gap in geographically varies, and state by state, it depends on whether you live in a Republican-dominated state or a Democratic-dominated state, because it turns out that the wage gap is smaller in Democratic-leaning states. 83.6% is what women earn compared to men, compared to Republican-leaning states, where women earn 79.4% of the wage that men do. Is that unsurprising to you, given that Republicans tend to be a lot more aggressive in ensuring, you know, investment in the kinds of things you were just saying?
Well, it's not a surprise, not just because of the difference in the politics of those states, but also if you look at the kinds of jobs that where the pay gap tends, or the industries where the pay gap tends to be largest. It's in those industries where there is a there's a requirement to work a specific set of hours, not a lot of flexibility, not a lot of worker power in those workplaces to determine the terms of their employment. And so you're going to find, for example, Republican states are more likely to be right to work states. And so having things like
meaning states that are unfriendly to unions.
Right, exactly. And so workers have less ability to push for things like predictable schedules or flexible schedules, less ability to have paid time off, and all of the different sort of flexible workplace terms that make it easier for women to press for all workers, but women in particular, to move up in the workplace.
Why has the gender wage gap persisted so stubbornly for two decades? I mean, you know, we've seen progress on women's rights fronts. We've seen regression when it comes to reproductive rights in particular. Mm-hmm. You would think that on the issue of wages, particularly as women are going to college in higher numbers than ever, they are assuming positions of leadership in greater numbers. There are more women representatives in Congress, not as many as there need to be, but still, compared to decades ago, there are more. Why has the wage gap, particularly over the last two decades, hardly moved?
Well, I think part of what you're seeing there is the limitation of individual solutions to this problem. So for a long time, there's been emphasis on things like coaching women to negotiate their salaries, or to, you know, sort of speak up in meetings, those kinds of things, being
the
more
sort of personal responsibility approach to solving issues.
Right. And even where you have sort of protections against wage discrimination, that still requires someone to file a complaint, to file suit. It's something that is person by person, workplace by workplace. And I think what we're really seeing is that only gets you so far. And if we really want to close this gap, we really have to address these larger structural issues, including how we treat professions that have traditionally been associated with women, and what kind of flexibility and support we give to people who are caregivers.
So what are the non-individual solutions? What are the systemic solutions to closing the gender wage gap? And I imagine that they're intimately linked to making the economy fairer as a whole, for working people as a whole, because of course, when women earn equal pay and have better working conditions, everybody does. And that holds even more true for women of color, for Black women, for Latina women, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's worth mentioning, we talk about the impact of caregiving largely falling to women on the pay gap. And, you know, it's worth pointing out that the children that they're caring for, the elderly parents, the disabled loved ones, we should care about those folks too. We should care about them having access to quality care and them having all of the support that they need. And so this is not just the impact is on a wage gap for women, but the impact of us not valuing this work and not really emphasizing care work impacts all of us. So in terms of structural solutions, I would say, investing in affordable childcare, sort of on both sides of that equation. So raising the standards and incomes of childcare workers, and at the same time, providing support so families can still afford to access childcare. And same for home health aides and other kinds of support for caregiving that happens in the home. In addition to that, one of the most important things is just having flexible workplaces. We've seen post-pandemic the increase in sort of hybrid, where people are home a couple of times a week, or sort of split schedules where, you know, maybe you put in half of your work day in the morning and have a break for when the kids get home from school, and then you finish up later in the evening. Those kinds of policies also make it much easier for women to move up in the workplace, to have the same potential earnings throughout the course of their career as their male counterparts.
There's also the issue of unions, right? I mean, we're seeing labor organizing ticking up. It is, you know, although overall the U.S. is, remains a country where union power is pretty weak in the last few years, in particular, since the pandemic, since the second or third year of the pandemic in particular, we started seeing ramping up of labor organizing efforts. Some of that also has to do with the fact that some of these union efforts are seeing success because the Biden administration has put in place a more progressive approach on labor rights at the White House. But is that something, union power, that can really help close the gender wage gap? And if so, what do you want the Biden administration to do? Because time is running out. You never know who's going to get elected in 2024 and is going to set the clock back again on labor rights.
Well, I would say absolutely, labor power is extremely important. And it's important not just in terms of workers having power to negotiate in a given workplace, but we know that when workers come together and organize and fight for a fair workplace for themselves, they also become more active in our political and policy debates. And so to the extent that what's needed is not just for a particular employer or particular industry to improve conditions, but also for changes to be made at a federal level or in terms of our policy, the strengthening of unions is also the strengthening of worker political power. In terms of ways for the Biden administration to support that, I think there are a number of ways that they can in terms of their power over the administrative agencies involved. There is a limitation in the sense that we really need congressional action to be impactful. And that's something that we need to have a Congress that's really willing to work for workers in order to have the laws in place that protects the right to organize.
Tell me about CPD's Fed Up campaign and how that plays into discussions around the equal pay day.
Sure. So, well, I think there are a few things. I think our Fed Up campaign, just to give some context on that, is a campaign that is targeting the Federal Reserve and really calling on them to be responsible for both sides of their dual mandate. So not just focus on inflation, but also focus on getting us to full employment. And historically, the Fed has really focused on inflation to the detriment of the labor force. And we see that happening right now as they raise interest rates. And you can see in reporting that the sort of yardstick they're using for determining success is the level of unemployment and the level of wage growth. And they're considering higher unemployment to be actually a good sign in terms of lowering inflation. And that's really exactly backwards. And part of the problem there is when you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail thing. So the Federal Reserve is really focused on raising or lowering interest rates, which is a very blunt instrument. And again, what's needed if we really want to tackle inflation is to do something about corporate power. Corporations are able to raise prices when there aren't enough competitors in a market to push back against it. And we've allowed companies to consolidate, industries to become more concentrated, and corporations to have a lot of power over both their workers and their consumers. And so again, it's a problem of congressional action and Congress really abdicating its role in addressing inflation, which means the Federal Reserve is coming in with this very blunt and ultimately ineffective instrument.
Well, finally, Michelle, where can people find out more and get involved with the work that Center for Popular Democracy is doing, particularly on the issues of the economy?
Sure. So they can go to our website, which is populardemocracy.org. And we have a number of campaigns that folks can participate in terms of worker justice, access to healthcare, access to housing, and the full range of supports that are needed for working families.
And we link to that from our website as well. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
My guest has been Michelle Kilpatrick, co-director of advocacy and mobilization at the Center for Popular Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.